Members, I'm going to call the meeting to order. And we're going to start out by a presentation from the specialty courts. Mr. Shorba, if you want to start by stating your name into the record and proceeding.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Shorba. I'm the State Court Administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch, and I'm joined today by Judge Robert Rancourt, who's a district judge in the 10th Judicial District, seated in Chisago County. Mr. Rancourt is also co-chair of our Drug Court Initiative Committee, which he'll talk a little bit about, as well as, he may not tell you, but president of the chairman of the board of the National Association of Drug Court Professionals. So we're very happy that he is able to join us. We'll be joined later in the presentation by Judge Todd Barnett and Judge Carrie Meyer from Hennepin County, who will be talking about their experiences with problem-solving courts. I want to thank the Chair Hillstrom for inviting us to talk a little bit about problem-solving courts here in Minnesota. Our goal this afternoon is to do a number of things. One is to give you an overview of problem-solving courts in Minnesota with information on statewide efforts we're doing to strategically implement problem-solving courts in all of our counties. We'd also like to review what we consider a very successful recent evaluation of drug courts in Minnesota. And then finally, Judges Barnett and Meyer will talk a little bit about their experience dealing with issues in these problem-solving courts. Problem-solving courts represent a shift in the way courts are handling certain court cases and working with stakeholders in our justice system. In this approach, courts work closely with prosecutors, public defenders, probation officers, social workers, and other justice partners to really develop a strategy that will help pressure an individual into completing treatment and abstaining from repeating the behaviors that brought them to court. This approach is used in more than just drug court, as we'll talk about in a moment. At present, the judicial branch has 37 problem-solving courts throughout the state. These are really just specialized court calendars where we use, as I mentioned, the coercive power of the court to closely monitor our defendant's progress towards sobriety and recovery by use of frequent drug testing, ongoing treatment, regular check-ins, and the use of sanctions and incentives to help the offender to a sober and law-abiding life. I just want...
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So are you going to talk about how they're funded in your presentation, or should I ask questions about that now?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I am going to talk about how they're funded.
Okay, thank you.
So I just want to briefly mention a little bit about each of these different problem-solving courts, and then Judge Rancourt will talk in a little bit more detail. Drug courts, of course, focus on the individual's addiction to alcohol and other drugs and try to, through the experience of the court interaction, ensure that we are laying a solid foundation for the person being able to achieve long-term recovery. We currently have 12 drug courts across the state of Minnesota. The second category is DWI and hybrid DWI courts. And what I mean by hybrid DWI courts is not only dealing with the DWI offense, but also dealing with other drug issues in those hybrid courts. Public safety, of course, is a top priority among all models of these courts, but especially with the drinking and driving issue, trying to get particularly repeat offenders to overcome obstacles which have caused them not to be able to quit this negative habit in the past. To effectively manage these issues and to best treat this population, these courts utilize increased supervision, frequent alcohol and other drug testing, and driver's license reinstatement plans, because wanting and needing to provide transportation is one of the reasons why there is repeat offenses with the DWI issues. We have 9 DWI courts and 8 hybrid DWI courts across the state. The 4th Judicial District, in conjunction with Hennepin County, has implemented a Veterans Court in 2010 with the mission to promote public safety and assist and support veterans and their families. The target population consists of defendants who have served in the United States Armed Forces and who are experiencing treatable behavioral and chemical health issues, for example, PTSD, anger management, domestic violence, and/or substance abuse or chemical dependency. Juvenile drug courts focus on the younger population and have many characteristics and needs specific to that model. Most important is the fact that many of the young people in these courts are still living at home and are under the supervision of caregivers. Due to their age and the relatively short period of time using alcohol and other drugs, providing a definitive diagnosis of dependence for juveniles regarding the use of alcohol and other drugs is sometimes difficult, which makes these courts different. And issues come into play such as school performance, teenage pregnancy, gang involvement, transportation, appropriate housing, which make these very unique court environments. And Judge Rancourt previously presided over a juvenile drug court, so he can talk a little bit more about that. Family dependency courts promote recovery through a coordinated response to families who have a child found to be in need of protection or services, where also at least one of the parents has a substance abuse disorder. And the goal of family dependency courts is to engage parents in treatment long enough to experience the benefits of treatment and ensure the best interests of the child through parental and family recovery from alcohol and other drug problems. And as you can see, we have three of those operating in the state. Finally, mental health courts are courts that focus on people who have been charged with a crime but who have a psychiatric disability. And the purpose of the court is to deal with the crime in a way that addresses the person's mental health needs. The mental health disability is the focus rather than just the criminal behavior, and we currently have two of those courts operating in the state. This map just gives you an idea of the geographic dispersion of our problem-solving courts. They are operating right now in 8 of our 10 judicial districts, and Judge Rancourt's going to talk a little bit about our efforts to expand the problem-solving court model to all 87 counties. You also have a handout which on the back of the map shows you the specific counties and the type of courts that are operating across the state. Our funding for the current fiscal year, the courts are funded from a variety of sources as seen on this slide. Our fiscal year 13 budget includes a general fund appropriation of almost $1.5 million. The Minnesota Office of Justice Programs has contributed $385,000. The Office of Traffic Safety, a little over $1 million. Department of Human Services, $421,000. And then the remainder of the $4.4 million is made up of $1.374 million in federal grants. I'd now like to turn over to Judge Rancourt to talk a little bit about the benefits of problem-solving courts and our drug court initiative.
Thank you, Mr. Sherba. We have a question from Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Sherba, can you tell me, so the funding for 2013 for the federal grants and the money from the Office of Justice Programming, is that just one-time money or ongoing money, or do you know when that money stops coming?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, it's a variety. We could get you that breakdown. Grants are usually provided over a multi-year period, so some of the grants in the next fiscal year will expire, some will continue, so there is a variety of breakdowns, and I can provide that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, and Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Sherba, would any of those grants, do you know, be affected by sequestration?
Mr. Sherba.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I do not know the specific answer to that, so I can try to find out, but I don't know.
Judge Rancourt.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I do thank all of you for your public service and the opportunity to present to all of you today on the issue of drug courts. About 12 years ago when I was appointed to the bench, one of the matters that I was assigned to is the impact of alcohol and drugs on the courts and looking at criminal justice reform, and that's how I really got into this idea of drug courts, if you will, as a criminal justice reform idea. Currently, as Jeff has indicated, we have 37 drug courts and problem-solving courts in the state of Minnesota. Nationally, there's 2,644 drug courts and 1,099 problem-solving courts in the United States. The benefits of drug courts are significant, both from a cost standpoint, but they also have a positive impact on the human condition. Drug courts work best for those individuals with high risk and high needs. When I say high risk, I'm not talking about violent offenders. I'm talking about criminogenic factors. And criminogenic needs that can be described as dynamic risk factors that, when addressed or changed, affect the offender's risk for recidivism, such as criminal personality, antisocial attitudes, values and beliefs, low self-control, criminal peers, substance abuse and dysfunctional family history. Other risk factors are deemed static, things that don't change, such as prior arrests.
Judge Rancourt, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if members and staff and testifiers could turn off their cell phones, we're having a lot of interruption with the technology here. So, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. May I proceed?
Yes.
Thank you. Those factors cannot be changed, which are static, such as prior arrests and criminal convictions. An example of that would be if your father is in prison, obviously that will be a static factor that will never change. The idea of a drug court is to use proper assessment tools or uniform assessment tools throughout the state so that criminogenic needs that can be changed or prioritized, so that services are focused, our resources are focused on the greatest criminogenic needs. As a result of the proper assessment tool and the proper placement of drug court participants in drug court, you end up with reduced criminal justice costs. More research has been published nationally on the effects of adult drug courts than virtually all other criminal justice programs combined. By 2006, the scientific community had concluded from advanced statistical procedures called meta-analysis, which I'm sure many of you are aware of, which is defined as an advanced statistical procedure that yields the most conservative and rigorous estimates on the average effects of intervention. The drug courts reduce criminal recidivism, typically measured by lower rearrest rates and new offenses and technical violations. The results of the research of the five meta-analysis findings showed that on average, drug courts reduce crime rates by an average of approximately 8 to 26%, more than the comparison group. Again, these were the averages. It should be noted that 78% of the courts analyzed by the meta-analysis significantly reduced crimes, with the best drug courts reducing crime by as much as 35 to 45%. The economic realities, as you all know, facing our nation and our state are exacerbated by over $60 billion in annual expenditures on corrections alone. That's just corrections alone. One in 100 adult Americans are behind bars. Approximately 60% of individuals arrested for most types of crimes test positive for illicit drugs at the time of arrest. 80% of inmates have a serious history of drug abuse. 60 to 80% of drug abusers will commit a new crime upon release. Untreated, an addict will cost the community $47,000 per year and $1.25 million over a lifetime in emergency room episodes, STDs, car crashes, arrests, and victimization. Drug courts reduce jail present time, reduce crime, and lower criminal justice costs, saving taxpayers nationally upwards of $8.3 billion in 2009. In addition, drug courts transform individuals who previously drained the system of resources and turned them into productive tax-paying citizens. Drug courts have provided a significant return on investment when you consider only direct and measurable offsets, such as reduced rearrest, law enforcement contact, court hearings, and the use of jail or prison beds. When considering other benefits, including reduced foster care placement and health care utilization, drug courts can provide cost benefits of up to $27 for every dollar invested. As a result, drug courts save from $2,000 to $12,000 per participant, which cost savings are typically realized within the same budget year in which the initial investment was made. In preparation of this presentation today, I did look at statistics, if you will, from the Department of Corrections that came out in July of 2012. And as you all know, we have approximately 9,500 people in custody in the corrections prisons in Minnesota at this time. Approximately 2,236 of those are in prison primarily on convictions for drug or alcohol-related offenses. That does not mean the other part of that population that's on convictions for other offenses don't have alcohol and drug problems. It just relates to the primary convictions. I looked at the cost analysis of housing one prisoner per day, $84.59, according to the statistics from the Department of Corrections. So when I calculated, I noticed that this particular population, and I don't know how many of them are violent offenders that are in this category. But obviously it costs approximately $196,000 per day to house just that population of drug and alcohol offenders, about $6 million per month, about $72 million per year. The average drug course cost per participant is approximately $7,600 a year. I mean, that's when you talk about criminal justice reform, that's the reason we are looking at these types of issues. On mental health issues, as many of you have heard, there's a lot of debate going on with some of the mental illness issues in our country relating to violence and things that are occurring as a result of mental illness. As part of our problem-solving court approach, we do have mental health courts, which I think prompted the National Journal in a recent article to indicate that these courts should be looked at for the purposes of addressing some of the issues that we are facing as state legislators as well as national legislators, and trying to figure out how to handle some of these mental health issues because of the great amount of resources that are expended in this area. The National Journal quote is, "The need for more and better mental health services is a common refrain after violent tragedies such as the mass shooting last month in Newtown, Connecticut, or recent instances of subway passengers pushed under the tracks in New York City. Service providers grapple with limited resources. Judges point to the growing number of mental health courts that offer mentally ill criminal defendants treatment-based alternatives to jail, a success story. An offshoot of the popular drug court, mental health courts were the product of judges, prison officials, lawyers, and mental health advocates frustrated with a lack of options for mentally ill defendants." Again, I only raise that issue as an alternative to some of your discussions relating to dealing with those with mental health issues. We have systems in place, and those could be expanded. In addition, as you know, in Minnesota, we have many people, young children, are torn from their homes in child protection proceedings. And statistically, again, the numbers are quite large, if you will, as far as the number of child abuse instances reported in this state. And again, I looked at some research in preparation for this hearing today from the Department of Human Services, I believe, but in 2002, Minnesota had approximately 56,000 total referrals for child abuse and neglect. Of those, 6,229 reports were referred for investigation, and 4,668 children were victims of abuse or neglect in Minnesota in 2008 at a rate of 3.7 per 1,000 children. That's a big number. And the idea, of course, if you look at trauma-related issues with children, is to try to get them reunited in the safest way possible, if that's possible. So our family dependency treatment courts, as Jeff has indicated, do address some of those issues as well. One of our primary considerations as judges, when we sentence an individual or return a child to a parent, is public safety and, of course, the best interests of the child. It should be noted that only 30% of the individuals released from prison never reoffend. Remarkably, statistics show that 75% of drug court graduates remain arrest-free, and the largest drug court study to date, results showed reductions in crime can last as long as 14 years. The reason for some of these results are evidenced by the fact that drug courts provide more comprehensive and closer supervision than any other community-based programs, such as probation alone. Drug courts are 6 times more likely to keep offenders in treatment long enough for them to get better. That's the key, of course, is treatment. Unless substance abuse abusers, addicted offenders are regularly supervised by a judge and held accountable for keeping their obligation, 70% will drop out of treatment prematurely. Drug courts have also been a success in preserving families and saving abused and neglected children. Parents and family drug courts are more likely to go to treatment and complete it. Their children spend significantly less time in and out of home placements, such as foster care. Family reunification rates are 50% higher for them and their children, which is significant when you look at the bonding issues between parents and children and the adverse effects when that bonding is broken. Drug courts are currently serving our veterans who are returning home and appearing on our dockets facing charges stemming from substance abuse and mental health issues, including post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. A recent study by the Veterans Affairs in the United States showed that veterans are committing suicide once every 80 minutes. I believe as a country and a state, we are responsible for ensuring that whatever affects veterans suffering the task of defending us should be treated. In the U.S., we have 23,400,000 veterans approximately, with 1.7 million who are veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. One in five veterans have some symptoms of mental health disorders. One in four ages 18 to 25 have a substantial substance abuse disorder, and 270,000 are currently in our criminal justice system. That's a big number. Our recent Minnesota evaluation has shown the success of our Minnesota drug courts. That study evaluated 16 of the 37 drug courts in Minnesota, and the results mirror the national statistics and benefits which I have presented. Jeff will further get into that in a moment. As Jeff has indicated, I am co-chair of the Minnesota Drug Court Initiative, along with Dakota County Attorney Jim Backstrom. The DCI is responsible for advising the Judicial Council on long-term strategy and specific action steps needed to ensure the viability, quality, accountability, and sustainability of the overall drug court initiative. The DCI developed drug court operational standards, which provide a minimum level of uniform practices for drug courts, and that's very critical, because we just don't want drug courts to start popping up all over the place without following standards. It makes no sense. It's not a good practice, quite frankly, and it's a waste of money as far as I'm concerned. Drug court standards were approved by the Judicial Council in 2007 and revised in 2008 to include specific direction for DWI juvenile and hybrid courts. Currently, we have 34 counties in our state that have some type of drug court. Not as many counties as drug courts due to a number of counties operating more than one model of drug court. Example, Hennepin County has four courts, adult drug court, DWI, mental health, and veterans. 34 counties with a drug court means we have reached 39% of Minnesota counties. By the end of 2013, we can expect an additional four counties having a drug court. That will bring our total to 38, or 44% of the state where a person suffering from chemical addiction and or severe mental health problems can access a drug court. In the past...
Judge Rancourt.
Yes.
Sorry if I could interrupt for a question from Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. So if we're going to expand these courts, are we expanding at the rate you stated based on the money available or based on how quickly you can implement them? For example, if you had an unlimited amount of money, which you don't, would you be able to implement more, or is it really your capacity or your money?
Judge Rancourt.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I believe that we could expand at a greater rate with more money. There's no question about that. But we're also trying to do, and I'm impressed with the way our judicial leadership at the state, quite frankly, is trying to do this. The big issue, of course, is equal access for people around our state. We want people in the northern end of the state to have the same access as those in the metropolitan areas, of course. And the idea is for them to go through training, because a lot of our federal grants require training prior to get them getting federal funding. In fact, there's national standards being developed as we speak. I've been part of a committee on that, Representative Hillstrom. So there's national standards and maybe certification in the future. The Department of Justice, Bureau of Justice Assistance, Office of Justice Programs may require before you can get federal grant funding. So we're rolling this out in a way that we feel the courts are well served and the people in their courts are well served by following applicable standards that are going to give them the best results. So certainly money is always a factor. And as part of that issue, what we're trying to do is talk to our, and we're initiating this, talking to some of our other justice partners, other executive branch agencies, corrections, human services, other agencies that do benefit from these drug courts, to look at further implementation funding in the future. And I think that's something that may be able to come back with you at to in the future to take a look at. But yes, we just think that, and I've been around this, Representative Hillstrom, for some period of time now, and I was not a convert initially. It took me some time, to be quite honest. But I've seen the results of these. I had a young lady, and if we have a moment, I'll just share a short story with you. But she was in my juvenile drug court. And she came into my juvenile drug court from a holding cell, and she had purple hair and all this other stuff. And she came in, and she was very agitated. She was using methamphetamine. And, of course, young people are not deemed addicts because they haven't used long enough to become addicts. They're chronic users. So they're not DSM-4 addicts. But she came in, and she was very frustrated. And she got into our drug court. And I said, young lady, I was relatively new on the bench, and I said, young lady, I'm not going to quit on you. And she said, I'm not going to quit on you either. And I thought, what the heck does that mean, for starters? But she didn't, and I didn't. And she was in our juvenile drug court for about 14 months. Now, understand, she was failing school, did not have a job, had a terrible relationship with her family, and I wish I would have brought her a letter to share with you when she exited our drug court. She graduated from high school, reunited with her family, is a productive young lady at this time. And I compare that with one day I was reading an obituary, and it said a young girl who was 17 years old died after a long battle with addiction. Same age as this young girl who went through drug court. Now, I don't know the history of that young lady. I don't know if she had access to resources. I don't know what the situation was. But I keep that obituary in my chambers, and I look at it every day, because that's not right. I don't think we should have young people dying of addiction after long battles at 17 years old in this state or anywhere else. That's just my personal belief on that. So yes, if we could expand these courts in the future, we would like to have them in every county that needs them. But we also believe that a lot of the smaller rural counties, such as the one I'm in, could benefit by multi-county drug court approach. We have four counties basically combining resources for a drug court. And you get into some rule changes that may be necessary as far as criminal rule changes, getting across jurisdictional lines and things like that. But the DCI will be working on that as well in the future to address some of those concerns. I hope that answers you, Representative.
It does, and Madam Chair, members, I will be introducing a drug court bill next week, or maybe even tomorrow, which might be one of the vehicle bills that the committee considers using for the Omnibus Public Judiciary Finance Committee.
Thank you, and Judge Rancourt, actually, I have a quick question.
Yes.
You kind of just led us into it regarding the jurisdictional issues. I was going to ask you how that works, if there's any leeway, or if somebody just hopes to get arrested in a county that has one of the drug courts available. And I was specifically going to ask about the mental health courts and where those were, and if there's any plan to put any in northern Minnesota or greater Minnesota, I guess.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The mental health courts, I believe, right now in Ramsey County and Hennepin. So we have two of the largest counties having mental health courts at this time. Plans as far as expansion, again, we haven't had requests at the DCI. The way this works, Madam Chair, is that if people are interested in establishing a drug or problem-solving a court, they submit a plan to the Drug Court Initiative Advisory Committee, which then submits a request to our Judicial Council, which is our governing body. And part of that plan is that they've been educated, there's been a sustainability plan submitted, so that once their grant funding would run out, if they do have it, there's a sustainability plan to keep those courts going. Because one of the things we don't want to do is to start these courts up, have people receive the benefit, and then shut them down. I mean, that doesn't work. And many of the judges in some of the outstate communities, even though they don't have a real drug court per se or problem-solving court, are using review-type status hearings for a lot of these folks, so that they keep coming back before the court during the periods of their probation. One of the concerns we have as judges is that we have sentencing guidelines with presumptive commits to prison in a lot of our drug cases. And for those nonviolent offenders, when we're looking at any form of durational or dispositional departure, particularly dispositional departures, and placing them on probation, we want to be in a position that we know that the public is going to be, the public safety is going to be considered, as well as their treatment needs. And the drug court's a good vehicle for that, as well as mental health courts. And we're seeing more and more of this, Madam Chair, people with mental health issues coming into our courts, co-occurring disorders with their drug issues. So the drug issues are permeating now into mental health issues, which are extremely expensive for society, as you know.
So. Okay. Thank you. You can continue.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. We have a question from Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Judge. I think I heard right, you're in Chisago?
Yes,
County?
I am.
Yeah, Todd Shuffleman, Judge Shuffleman, yeah, lives in my district,
okay,
and I know him. So you spoke that there must be a four-county coalition for your drug court that you help out with, and what four counties are those, or how does that work?
Yeah, right. I don't have a multi-county court. We just had a juvenile drug court, Representative Scott, which we no longer have.
Okay.
But The multi-county approach is using in some of the southern counties right now. It's an approach where you have to really get the county attorneys on board, public defenders on board, sheriffs on board. So there's some point of selling this to everyone, and then implementing the multi-court approach, multi-county approach, which has been successful. Because, again, you are spreading your resources out. The idea is to get the numbers necessary into these drug courts and problem-solving courts with the types of individuals that can best be served, those high-risk, high-need individuals I was telling you about. They have the best results. So you don't want to merge individuals that don't have high-risk, high-need with low-risk, low-need folks, because you can create a problem for those low-risk and low-need folks. It's a different issue. So that's the multi-county approach is something that is not only happening in this state, but nationally as well.
Thank you, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I might, I'm assuming then that it's where these drug courts are set up, it's according to the greatest need. Because I look, you know, I live in Anoka County, and I can't think for the life of me that there isn't a need there. But perhaps it's prioritized by where the greatest need is. Is that correct?
Judge Reincourt?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Representative Scott, that's not necessarily correct.
Okay.
Again, it's a culture of the bench to some extent, Representative Scott, okay. is to, and also probation and corrections and people that may want to implement these types of courts. Anoka County, that's your county, you've indicated? Anoka County currently has started a veterans treatment program. It's not necessarily a veterans treatment drug court, but they're starting to bring veterans in using the drug court model to some extent. Some courts do not want to be, I think, directed, if you will, from the standpoint of funding issues and things like that, meaning that obviously if the courts are going to be funded through the judicial branch, they have to comply with certain standards and other conditions, which I've stated. Some courts don't want to do that at this point. It's changing, though, Representative Scott, I think greatly, and I think people are more open to take a look at these because the need is there, particularly in our DWI area and drugs. You know, in our courts, approximately 80%, I think, of cases that appear before me, either family court cases, eviction cases, civil cases, will have some type of drug or alcohol component. It's incredible to see. And we have to have a vehicle to address some of these folks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one last question, and I can't help but ask this. In your experience, and I don't know how long you've been on the bench, but and maybe you do have some empirical data on this, but of those people that fall into these specialty courts, how much or what percentage would you say of those folks come from fatherless homes?
Judge Reincourt.
You know, I'm not really sure of those statistics, but when I was preparing for today's hearing and I looked at the, again, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I will get that right. And Representative Scott, when I was looking at the statistics today for the purposes of this hearing again, I was looking at some of the folks that are in prison, and that may give you some idea as to what we are dealing with. The number in prison with grade 0 to 8 without any education, 385. Grades 9 through 11, about 2,400. So those that have not finished high school constitute 25% of the prison population. High school graduates constitute another 25%. GED, another 25%. So about 75%, either not high school graduates, high school graduates, or GEDs. College, about 17%. And other unknown, I'm not sure what that is, but it's about 2.4%. So it gives you some idea of the criminality and factors.
Thank you, Judge Reincourt, and please continue.
Thank you. And I'll just conclude, Madam Chair, by indicating, and I think one of the questions that Representative Hilstrom was talking about, some of these federal grants. We've been talking nationally to some of the agencies looking at sustainability grants from the federal government. And that's something they don't like to do, you know, because of a lot of the states losing some of their federal funding. But we're still talking to them about that. We're going to continue to talk to them about that. Drug courts at the national level have received bipartisan support, as they have in the state of Minnesota. And we appreciate that. And the reason they have is they're cost-effective. They require responsibility. There's public safety elements. So there's a lot of factors that go into why they're supported. And In drug courts, we believe that when one person rises out of drugs and crime, we all rise. When a baby is born drug-free, we all rise. And when a parent is reunited with a family, we all rise. And when a veteran receives benefits and treatment they have earned, we all rise. And that's why we're strong proponents. And I've been fortunate, because of my position, to travel throughout this country as well as internationally. And this is this is impacting everyone, not only in the state of Minnesota, throughout all our states in our country relating to increased prison costs, incarceration, mental health issues, but also internationally. And this is a vehicle, because I think it's been studied so much, that it's been shown to be a reliable criminal justice reform that does have significant net cost benefits. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judge Rancourt. And Mr. Shorba?
Madam Chair, one of the reasons why attitudes are changing is results. And Judge Rancourt talked a little bit about national results, and I want to talk a little bit about our own results here in Minnesota. The State Court Administrator's Office recently completed a 2.5-year study of over 500 adult drug court participants. The study was not a cost-benefit analysis, but was looking at results with regard to recidivism and other factors from these participants. We compared the 500 adult drug court participants with almost 650 comparison participants, and what we saw from the study was reduced recidivism, increased community engagement by drug court graduates, and less overall incarceration. As you can see from this slide, new charges and convictions were lower for drug court participants. From drug court entry through 2.5 years, and drug court lasts approximately 1.5 years, one quarter, or 26% of drug court participants, had new charges compared to 41% of the comparison group. Conviction rates, which is not on the slide, were also lower for drug court participants, about 17% versus 32% for the comparison group. So you can see a reduction in crime in both areas. But in addition, we tried to measure what we call the promotion of social engagement. One of the goals of drug courts is to ensure participants are accountable for their decisions and improve not only the quality of their life, but the quality of their families and communities. As you can see from the slide, in all of the indicators, employment, diploma, owning a home, having a valid license, paying child support, drug court, those in drug court had improved as a result of their participation. And some of these are quite significant. Employment, for example, improved from 35% at the beginning to 63% upon completion or discharge. So significant increases in each of these particular categories. The one measure of cost is looking at incarceration. Over 2.5 years, drug court participants spend half as much time in prison as the comparison group and two-thirds as much time incarcerated overall. And drug court participants in almost all courts spend less time in jail over the 2.5 years than the comparison group. And you can see here among drug court participants over those time periods in the comparison group, a savings of about a little over $2,500 or so. So there is some cost savings. This was not a formal cost-benefit analysis, but it did look at the incarcerations that we were seeing. The other thing I'll mention before I turn it over to Judges Barnett and Meyer is to talk a little bit about other problem-solving courts. These are courts that use techniques similar to drug courts, but not quite the same. Most of them involve less treatment in domestic violence courts. We now have domestic violence courts operating in a number of counties, and these courts are designed to address what we see as traditional problems of domestic violence. Threats to the victim, lack of defendant accountability, high recidivism, and we use the same techniques of intense judicial scrutiny of the defendant and close cooperation between the judiciary and social services to try to curb domestic violence negative results. The other court, which is not part of the judicial branch, that's why it's in this category, is a family dependency court being operated between the White Earth Nation and our Cass County court in the 9th Judicial District, where we try to have state court judges working with tribal judges to co-facilitate the resolution of family dependency issues and juvenile wellness issues between the state court and the tribal court. This is a joint cooperative effort that has received national attention and awards as a model around the country to try to bring tribal courts and state courts together, and it's been very successful. Unless there are other questions, I'm now going to ask Judges Barnett and Meyer to come up and talk a little bit about their experiences with these courts.
Are there any questions from members at this point? No. Thank you. Oh. Yeah, members, if I could have somebody review the minutes from February 13th and move those minutes.
So moved.
Thank you. Representative Bly moves the minutes. Are there any corrections? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Minutes are adopted. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
I am Judge Barnett. You want me to go first, or you want them to introduce themselves?
Judge, why doesn't the other testifier introduce herself, and then Judge Barnett, if you want to start.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carrie Meyer. I'm a judge in Hennepin County.
Thank you. Judge Barnett.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this opportunity to be here before you today. I've been asked to cover three areas in problem-solving court. To cover my experience in problem-solving court, specifically drug court. Also, to talk a little bit about why I think problem-solving court is successful compared to the traditional court, and also to talk about some of the participants in drug court. And I think it's important that you, when I talk about my perspective, that you know that my entire legal career has been in the criminal justice system, that I started out as a public defender, and I was doing that for 15 years before I was a county attorney for about 2 years, and now been on the Hennepin County bench for 7, and all spent in Hennepin County. So without a doubt, I would say that problem-solving court has been the most rewarding experience I've had, bar none, compared to any of the positions that I've held. When you look at problem-solving courts from a judge perspective, you're really asking us as judges to get out of our traditional independent role and to share some of our decision-making power that we have, and to do it collectively in a team approach, and to focus on participants' recovery and law-abiding behavior. In the traditional criminal court, the focus is always on the appropriate consequence for a specific crime, whereas in the problem-solving courts, we really look at what the person's underlying issues are that bring them into court. And that's not to say that all people in the criminal justice system belong in problem-solving court, but it's to say that we really try to deal with the issues that are bringing them to court because of drugs and alcohol. And so we look at success differently than we would in the traditional court model. Traditional court model, as an advocate, of course, I looked at what was the best deal for my client. As a prosecutor, I looked at what justice could I get for a victim. And also, in both roles, I looked at, when I went to trial, am I getting the best result for that particular individual? But as a judge in problem-solving court, stepping out of that traditional role is asking us to look and be actively participating in the success of an individual before us. And you see this, like Judge Rancourt was talking about, the individual he had before himself, is that they come in initially resistant. They're drug addicts. They're not happy to be in court. and they're not happy to see a judge. But what happens is that you take these high-risk, high-need individuals that you see initially, at least in Hennepin County, once a week, and then you see them every 2 weeks, and then maybe you'll see them once a month. And you see them in these judicial review hearings, and what happens is each time you see something a little different. One thing that you notice right away is that when a person is sober, they look healthier. Their skin looks better, their hair looks better, their overall appearance looks better. But as a judge, what we start to hear about are these small incremental successes that they're having. In treatment, we hear about 30 days of sobriety, then 60, then 90, then 6 months, and then a year. And then you hear about the success what they're having getting with their kids. A lot of our participants, both male and female, have lost contact with their kids or have lost their kids. And so you hear about them moving from supervised visitation to unsupervised visitation, then moving from unsupervised visitation to overnights. And then eventually you hear about them being able to be reunited with their kids. You hear about participants making amends with loved ones and parents. In drug court, you hear about the success they're having addressing mental health issues, medical issues, housing, finding work, and pursuing educational goals. And so what's really different in problem-solving court and what you see as a judge is that you actually see life changes that we normally won't see in a traditional court, where we'll see a person from maybe the arraignment, the omnibus hearing, the trial, maybe a sentencing, and they're done. We won't see them again. But in problem-solving court, we get to see progression throughout the whole process towards graduation. And so what is it about problem-solving court that I think that is the success and what I think is the components that makes it work for Hennepin County, I think other places? And I think I'm struck by what I hear from a lot of the participants. And in one way, it's sad, and the other way is very powerful. And that is, you hear, this is the first time anyone cared about me. Because they come into the system with distrust of all the professionals. They come into the system not wanting to be there. And I think towards the end, they finally believe that in problem-solving court, someone cares about them. Also, I think what happens is that the support that they have within problem-solving court, they get the courage to succeed, where in other places, there's a lot of discouraging influences. I think the review hearings are helpful. The team approach that we take is great. When you look at the individuals, and I'll give you some quick examples of three people and then one person outside of drug court. One participant, Pedro, came to drug court from Chicago, gangbanger, came up here, addicted to drugs and was selling drugs. Now he's a graduate of drug court. He's a volunteer in his kid's school. He's active in the community. That's a big change. Willie, who was in our drug court, same situation. Criminal, one of the most powerful things that he said to me, and I think it really hits home as a judge, is that these people are looking at you as this hero, and to me, they are the heroes for us. And one of the things that Willie said was he's never had a father figure until he came to drug court. And now, recently, about 6 or 9 months ago, he's a father. And he came to visit me down at the courthouse, and the thing that he talked about was being engaged in his kid's life and not being absent. I had another person by the name of Sarah, young person, probably about 19, came to drug court. When she came to drug court, her parents came with her every time. She would sit in one side of the drug courtroom, they would sit in the other. And eventually, they, by the end, were sitting together, but more importantly, now Sarah works with her mom at Target. And, you know, these are the things that I think as judges we really appreciate. But for me, I've taken some of these drug court or problem-solving court key components to traditional court. And I've used them in cases that Judge Rancourt was talking about where I'm departing in cases. I have people come back for reviews. One case that's very successful is a guy by the name of Thomas who came before me with several DWIs. And I took a chance on him, and not knowing, we never know as judges what's going to happen, but he in particular was successful with reviews, remained sober, and now he owns his own used car lot. And so problem-solving court can be impactful even outside of its arena in the traditional court setting.
Thank you, Judge Barnett. We have a question from Representative Cornish.
Judge Barnett, this isn't really anything to do with the effectiveness or the worth of the drug court, but what why was he here from Chicago, and what are the percentages of people you see come through your court or from out of state or from Chicago, just as near as you could guess?
Well, Judge Barnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I Representative. Out of state, that's kind of tough for me to guess. I would maybe 30% maybe came from out of state, maybe more. I'm not sure about that, but I can tell you that most of the drug court participants who were not only addicts, the ones that actually were at some point in their lifetime dealt drugs, most of those people did come up here for that particular reason and to engage in illegal drug transactions. But I would say that if you look at our drug court criteria that we have and that the that we've gotten from the judicial branch, we can't take violent offenders. So when you look at the people who we have, they don't have violent offenses in their past that would make them ineligible for drug court. So anyone who is a violent offender for Hennepin County Drug Court couldn't be admitted.
Representative Cornish.
Thank you. I like I say, I support your specialty courts, and it wasn't anything to do with that. It was just indicative of a bigger problem that we have in Minnesota with people coming to this state to get cured. So thank you.
All right.
Thank you. Judge Barnett, are you finished?
Yes.
Okay, Judge Meyer, if you'd like to start.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I want to speak to you a little bit about Hennepin County's DWI court. It is really Judge John Hollihan's baby. He's raised it, and through total leap of faith, he's going to turn that over to me when he retires later this year. I spent the last year filling in for him whenever possible, and I've gotten to know a lot of the participants, and so I want to share some of that information with you. As you all know, alcohol has a huge impact in society. Being a legal drug, it is readily accessible, and we certainly see a large number of people who abuse it and are addicted to it in the court system. We also are a state in which driving is the norm, right? We are very car dependent. And so we have a lot of people with DWIs. What we do in drug court is the people who are on their third or even fourth within 10 years, which you all have made a second degree and first degree DWIs. We will take those into our drug court if they're Hennepin County residents and they choose to come. I'll tell you, most people who go, who are offered drug or DWI court, do not accept it. It is extremely more rigorous than simply doing their time in the workhouse. But for those who do, we see incredible success stories and healing. Excuse me. I first saw, as Judge Rancourt talked about, the effects of alcoholism on parents and child protection. That's where it really became sort of pulled at my heart, the amount of damage that was being done to families because of parents' addictions. Parents who seemed to have it all together would think that they had control over it and could have just one drink. Well, just one drink turns into a weekend away from home, and they forgot their kids were under their control. So it's a powerful addiction that overcomes even a parent's love for a child. And so I'm very excited to be part of our DWI court to help people to heal from that addiction and achieve and maintain sobriety. Our DWI court is probably the most diverse courtroom in the building. We have men and women almost in equal numbers. There are more men, but we have a very large contingent of women. We have all different ages. I have college students, and I have grandparents. economic diversity. I have a young man who just started in banking. I have people who've never worked before. Very successful man who lives on Lake Minnetonka, and he earned every dime of that money, but they're all addicted. All different races, different ethnicity. We have one of our calendars each week. We have a Spanish interpreter. That's where Spanish-speaking participants come so that they can listen to the entire calendar and understand it as well. Unfortunately, I have one of my child protection moms, right? So child protection ends. She found a relative to take custody of her child, and then child protection's done. She hadn't achieved sobriety, and we couldn't make her. We didn't have any more stick, but unfortunately, she picked up another DWI, and now she's active in DWI court and struggling there. But she's a great example, in a bad way, a great example, of the struggles that families deal with alcoholism, the loss of trust. There is nothing more certain than the unpredictableness of an addicted parent, right? The promises that they make to their children do not come true. And it's not because they don't want them to. It's not because they don't mean it when they make the promise. It's because they forget in the haze of being high or drunk. Many of our people are the absent fathers that Representative Scott was talking about. Not only did they have absent fathers, but they then were the absent father throughout their children's growing up. And what we've been able to achieve, Judge Hollihan in particular, but that team, is helping those people get clean and sober and then maintain that sobriety over a lengthy period of time. That's the beauty of problem-solving courts, is that we stick with them over a large period of time. We stay with them for over a year, providing, I like to think of it as this team that surrounds the participant who maybe is at such a low point they can't even stand on their own. We help them stand up, we stay close to them, and as they gather their strength, we start to step back. And we're there to catch them if they fall, and sometimes we have to, you know, that part of addiction is relapse, but that we're there for them, and that eventually we can just step back and they can make it on their own. They can run, and then they can become support for other people as well. Ultimately, if people who stick with the program, they gain that family trust back, both from their children and from their parents, as was stated earlier. That all combines for a sense of pride and self-worth that many of them haven't felt maybe ever. They talk about people, nobody's ever trusted me before. They have parents who were never said a kind word to them. And to have professionals who care about them, surround them, helps them to get that pride and self-worth they maybe never had before. And they get their families back, which is so important. Part of the question for your committee may be, well, why do we need the court involved with this? Why don't they just go to treatment and do their AA groups? And the issue is that it takes more than just an order to go to treatment. In regular court, that's what we do. Our regular court ends at sentencing. We tell them what to go do. And probation does their best, but they're overworked. And so if someone goes to treatment and they leave treatment, if they're on regular probation, it's going to take a while, maybe a week, for us to even know they left. If they're in DWI court, we're going to know pretty much immediately because the treatment providers are part of the team and they know exactly who to call. They know which probation officer to call about that particular person, and they call right away. They know that this is all part of the program that the participant is supposed to be in. And so we get that call right away. The judge gets a call right away. The rest in detention goes out if that's if they've left treatment, so that they get back in custody right away, which means that they stop using right away. Excuse me. So just to give you some idea, in our program, we use, you know, we're focused on the treatment, get sober, stay sober. So treatment, a lot of that is inpatient. These are people who are seriously addicted to alcohol, who are not able to achieve sobriety in their current living situation. So they go to a residential treatment, step down into maybe sober housing with aftercare. As in our drug courts, our treatment providers have expanded their treatment programs for our programs in order to be help achieve sobriety. Once they go home, we do home visits with police officers in our community. They actually go there after curfew. They do breathalyzers. They look for alcohol. When they find it, we know, and they're back in custody if they're using, especially. We use ignition interlock, and we have even before that became one of the requirements from the legislature, but it's been a very useful tool for us to ensure our main goal, which is not to drink and drive again. We require 12-step AA and proof of attendance. We provide study in action, which is sort of the plan, the introduction to AA. Treatment, sober living, and basically if people stumble, we're there to catch them. We require, when people move up in their level, in other words, they're progressing in the level, they have to write letters to us. Those are some of the most uplifting things that you'll ever see, the self-realization and understanding of people as they gather back. Their sense of self-worth has been really positive thing to read, and part of why I'm a believer in problem-solving courts. The other thing that we have in our DWI court, and I know it's true in drug court too, is volunteers. Judge Barnett told you about a graduate who's a volunteer. DWI court has over 23 volunteers who are there every week. They run AA for us. They run study in action for us. We have a volunteer who does our introduction to let people know, here's what the court is, here's what you're getting yourself into, do you have any questions? These are almost, I'd say they all are recovering alcoholics who've achieved their sobriety and they want to give back because service is sobriety. They live it, and they live it in our courtroom. It's part of how we're able to stay cost effective. We use incentives and sanctions, right? You mess up, you get a sanction, go to the workhouse, go to jail. That's sort of the last requirement, but lose privileges, your curfew gets earlier, is an example of an earlier sanction. And then we use incentives. If you do well, you graduate from treatment, we have people who donate coffee shop gift cards. We praise their good work. That's part of why some judges don't like problem-solving courts. They think, really, you're going to clap in court? Heck yeah, I'm going to clap. If somebody can get and stay sober and never drive drunk again, yeah, I'm okay with that. It may not be the most judicial moment, but it is for them. It's important that a judge is one of the people who has pride in them. What was the word you used? Oh, to be a person who cares. Yeah. I mean, for people who never had even a parent who could express their caring, to have a judge be a person who cares about them, who appreciates their success, is really important, and it's part of the hallmark for problem-solving courts.
Thank you, Judge Meyer. Are there questions from members? Representative Cornish.
I'm just going to, Madam Chair, encourage some of our members, if they ever get a chance, to go to a DWI drug court. It's a regular, you talk about judicial moments, sometimes it's a regular cry fest. I've seen the judge cry, the bailiff cry, probation officer cry, sometimes all at the same time. And the sanctions and the incentives are really good. They Sometimes they might get told that there, instead of being out, they're going to have to spend the weekend in jail. Or sometimes when they do really good, they give, like you say, a gift certificate. And there is a lot of applause sometimes. And then the graduations are really something, because you see this long program that they went through, and then they finally get to the end, and they get a couple people to come up and make speeches for them. And then they do their own speech if they can get through it all the way sometimes without emotion. But it's pretty impressive. So, and successful in Blue Earth County. Judge Johnson, he's Kurt Johnson, I think it is, in Blue Earth County, does a good job. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cornish. Are there questions from members? Representative Portman.
Well, I think Representative Cornish said it better than I could, but I spent an afternoon with Judge Hallahan, and it was a really amazing experience. So I would recommend to members that you take the time when you have it to go spend some time and see how these courts work.
Thank you. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have had a chance to participate in one of the graduations, too. I have a very, very good experience and very effective. Just a quick question, maybe for Judge Meyer or Judge Barnett, too. Are faith-based services allowed to be part of the process? And if so, how does that happen?
Judge Meyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rutkowski. Yes, faith-based support groups are allowed. Certainly, whatever it is that is the right hook for the person, right? Some people, you can just tell from, we call it the Rule 25, from their chemical dependency evaluation, when they talk about the only time I've ever had sobriety in the past, I was really active in my church, I was, you know, then we know that they're going to need something that's faith-based. 12 steps certainly can be. People can make it as faith-based as they want, how they identify with their higher power. But it needs to be a structured program that the probation officer can speak with, but their sober support at least can certainly be faith-based, and then the actual treatment itself can be too, as long as we have that open relationship with the treatment provider being part of the team.
The
Judge Barnett.
Madam Chair and Representative, there were two, if you're familiar with Teen Challenge, which is, you know, faith-based, they worked very well with two of our participants who, that's what they wanted, that's what they asked for. They didn't want to go to sort of the traditional treatment providers that we actually had, and they seeked out Teen Challenge as their provider, and they worked very well with us, and both of those participants graduated. And Teen Challenge's model is long-term treatment, so it all worked together with us in drug court. So I think, just like DWI court, drug court is willing to make arrangements and very flexible with anyone who wanted that type of structure.
Thank you, Judge Barnett. Then I guess I have a question following up. If you do look at the Rule 25 and decide that, you know, this person would benefit from a faith-based service, it would never be that the judge or the state would set that forward in the 12-step process as being a requirement of graduating from drug court. It would just be a completely voluntary basis whether or not somebody would be involved in a faith-based service. Is that correct?
That would be correct. In Hennepin County, I mean, you have to volunteer to be part of a drug court or DWI court. That's part of the requirement. The treatment provider, we would never force a person to go to Teen Challenge or any place like that or similar program. They would volunteer to go there. But, of course, that would be, if they, for some reason, were discharged from that program, that would be a violation of the rules that we have.
That's interesting. Are there any other questions from members? Seeing none, any further discussion? No? Thank you for presenting here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And members, the meeting is adjourned.